Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 28th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, Omicron spreads to more countries by Pan Pilas, The Associated Press. Scientists brace for wave propelled by Omicron by Andrew Meldrum. Battleground states, GOP cements hold on legislatures by Nick Corasaniti. Immigration, some states dropping contentious alien term by Acacia Coronado and following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19. Omicron spreads to more countries. Anthony Fauci says he would not be surprised if the variant is already in the United States as well. By Pan Pilas, The Associated Press, Byline, London. The new potentially more contagious Omicron variant of the coronavirus popped up in more European countries Saturday, just days after being identified in South Africa, leaving governments around the world scrambling to stop the spread. The UK on Saturday tightened its rules on wearing masks and on the testing of international arrivals after finding two cases. New cases were confirmed Saturday in Germany and Italy, with Belgium, Israel, and Hong Kong also reporting the variant has been found in travelers. In the U.S., Dr. Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious diseases expert, said he would not be surprised if the Omicron variant was already in the United States as well. We have not detected it yet, but when you have a virus that is showing this degree of transmissibility, it almost invariably is ultimately going to be essentially all over, Fauci said on NBC television. Because of fears that the new variant has a potential to be more resistant to the protection offered by vaccines, there are growing concerns around the world that the pandemic and associated lockdown restrictions will persist for far longer than hoped. Nearly 2 years since the start of the pandemic that has claimed more than 5 million lives around the world, countries are on high alert. Many have imposed travel restrictions on flights from southern Africa as they seek to buy time to assess whether the Omicron variant is more transmissible than the current dominant Delta variant. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said it was necessary to take targeted and precautionary measures after two people tested positive for the new variant in England. Right now, this is a responsible course of action to slow down the seeding and the spread of this new variant and to maximize our defenses, he told a news conference. Among the measures announced, Johnson said anyone arriving in England must take a PCR test for COVID-19 on the second day after their arrival and self-isolate until they provide a negative test. And if someone tests positive for the Omicron variant, then he said their close contacts will have to self-isolate for 10 days regardless of their vaccination status. He also said wearing masks in shops and on public transport will be required and said the independent group of scientists that advises the British government on the rollout of coronavirus vaccines has been asked to accelerate the vaccination program. From today, we're going to boost the booster campaign, he said. Britain's Department of Health said the two cases found in the UK were linked and involved travel from southern Africa. The British government also added four more countries, Angola, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zambia, onto the country's travel red list from Sunday. Six others, Botswana, Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, Lesotho, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe, were added Friday. That means anyone permitted to arrive from those destinations will have to quarantine. Many countries have slapped restrictions on various Southern African countries in the past couple of days, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, the European Union, Iran, Japan, Thailand, and the United States, in response to warnings over the transmissibility of the new variant. This goes against the advice of the World Health Organization, which has warned against any overreaction before the variant was thoroughly studied. Despite the banning of flights, there are mounting concerns that the variant already has been widely seeded around the world. Italy and Germany were the latest to report confirmed cases of the Omicron variant. An Italian who had traveled to Mozambique on business landed in Rome on November 11th and returned to his home near Naples. He and five family members, including two school-aged children, have tested positive, the Italian news agency La Presse said. In Germany, the Max von Pentikofer Institute, a Munich-based microbiology center, said the Omicron variant was confirmed in two travelers who arrived on a flight from South Africa on November 24th. The Dutch Public Health Institute said the Omicron variant was probably found in a number of the tested persons who were isolated after arriving Friday in Amsterdam on two flights from South Africa. The Institute said in a statement that further sequencing analysis is underway to determine for sure that it is the new variant. The results were expected Sunday. A total of 61 people were tested. Israel said it detected the new strain in a traveler who had returned from Malawi and was tracing 800 travelers who returned recently from southern African countries. And Australia said early Sunday its scientists were working to determine whether two people who tested positive for COVID-19 after arriving from southern Africa are infected with the Omicron variant. The variant's swift spread among young people in South Africa has alarmed health professionals, even though there was no immediate indication whether the variant causes more severe disease. A number of pharmaceutical firms, including AstraZeneca, Moderna, Novavax, and Pfizer, said they have plans in place to adapt their vaccines in light of the emergence of Omicron. Pfizer and its partner BioNTech said they are expecting to be able to tweak their vaccine in around 100 days. Some experts said the variant's emergence illustrated how rich countries' hoarding of vaccines threatens to prolong the pandemic. Fewer than 6% of people in Africa have been fully immunized against COVID-19. South Africa. Scientists brace for wave propelled by Omicron. By Andrew Meldrum, The Associated Press, Byline, Johannesburg. Worried scientists in South Africa are scrambling to combat the lightning spread across the country of the new and highly transmissible Omicron COVID-19 variant as the world grapples with its emergence. In the space of 2 weeks, the Omicron variant has sent South Africa from a period of low transmission to rapid growth of new confirmed cases. The country's numbers are still relatively low, with 2,828 new confirmed cases recorded Friday, but Omicron's speed in infecting young South Africans has alarmed health professionals. We're seeing a marked change in the demographic profile of patients with COVID-19. Rudo Mathiva, head of the intensive care unit at Soweto's Baragwanath Hospital, told an online news briefing. Young people in their 20s to just over their late 30s are coming in with moderate to severe disease, some needing intensive care. About 65% are not vaccinated, and most of the rest are only half vaccinated, Mathiva said. I'm worried that as the numbers go up, the public health care facilities will become overwhelmed. She said urgent preparations are needed to enable public hospitals to cope with a potential large influx of patients needing intensive care. We know we have a new variant, Mathiva said. The worst case scenario is that it hits us like Delta. We need to have critical care beds ready. What looked like a cluster infection among some university students in Pretoria ballooned into hundreds of new cases and then thousands, first in the capital city and then to nearby Johannesburg, South Africa's largest city. Studying the surge, scientists identified the new variant that diagnostic tests indicate is likely responsible for as many as 90% of the new cases, according to South Africa's health officials. Early studies show that it has a reproduction rate of 2, meaning that every person infected by it is likely to spread it to 2 other people. The new variant has a high number of mutations that appear to make it more transmissible and help it evade immune responses. The World Health Organization looked at the data on Friday and named the variant Omicron under its system of using Greek letters, calling it a highly transmissible variant of concern. It's a huge concern. We're all terribly concerned about this virus, Professor Willem Hanekom, director of the Africa Health Research Institute, told the Associated Press. This variant is mostly in Gauteng province, the Johannesburg area of South Africa. But we've got clues from diagnostic tests that suggest that this variant is already all over South Africa, said Hanekom, who is also co-chairman of the South African COVID-19 Variant Research Consortium. The scientific reaction from within South Africa is that we need to learn as much as soon as possible. We know precious little, he said. For example, we do not know how virulent this virus is, which means how bad is this disease that it causes. A key factor is vaccination. The new variant appears to be spreading most quickly among those who are unvaccinated. Currently, only about 40% of adult South Africans are vaccinated, and the number is much lower among those in the 20 to 40-year-old group. South Africa has nearly 20 million doses of vaccines made by Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. But the numbers of people getting vaccines is about 120,000 per day, far below the government's target of 300,000 per day. As scientists try to learn more about Omicron, the people of South Africa can take measures to protect themselves against it, said Hanekom. This is a unique opportunity. There's still time for people who did not get vaccinated to go and get the vaccine, and that will provide some protection, we believe, against this infection, especially protection against severe infection, severe disease, and death, he said. So I would call on people to vaccinate if they can. Battleground states, GOP cements hold on legislatures, by Nick Corasaniti, The New York Times Company. Republicans are locking in newly gerrymandered maps for the legislatures in 4 battleground states that are set to secure the party's control in the state house chambers over the next decade, fortifying the GOP against even the most sweeping potential Democratic wave elections. In Texas, North Carolina, Ohio, and Georgia, Republican state lawmakers have either created supermajorities capable of overriding a governor's veto or whittled down competitive districts so significantly that Republicans' advantage is virtually impenetrable, leaving voters in narrowly divided states powerless to change the leadership of their legislatures. Although much of the attention on this year's redistricting process has focused on gerrymandered congressional maps, the new maps being drafted in state legislatures have been just as distorted. The state houses have taken on towering importance. With the federal government gridlocked, these legislatures now serve as the country's policy laboratory, crafting bills on abortion, guns, voting restrictions, and other issues that shape the national political debate. This is not your founding father's gerrymander, said Chris Lamar, a senior legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center who focuses on redistricting. This is something more intense and durable and permanent. This redistricting cycle, the first in a decade, builds on a political trend that accelerated in 2011 when Republicans in swing states, including Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, drew highly gerrymandered state legislative maps. Since those maps were enacted, Republicans have held both houses of state government in all 3 places for the entire decade. They never lost control of a single chamber, even as Democrats won some of the state's races for president, governor, and Senate. All three of those northern states are likely to see some shift back toward parity this year, with the new independent commission drawing Michigan's maps, and Democratic governors in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania probably will force a process to be completed by the courts. Gerrymandering is a tool used by both parties in swing states, as well as less competitive ones. Democrats in deep blue states, such as Illinois, are moving to increase their advantage in legislatures. And Republicans in deep red states, such as Utah and Idaho, are doing the same. But in politically contested states, where Republicans hold full control, legislators are carefully crafting a GOP future. They are armed with sharper technology, weakened federal voting statutes, and the knowledge that legal challenges to their maps may not be resolved in time for the next elections. Texas, North Carolina, and Ohio have signed into law new maps with a significant Republican advantage. Georgia is moving quickly to join them. Republicans say that the growth of such heavily skewed legislatures is a result of the party's electoral victories and of where voters choose to live. State legislative districts are by nature much smaller in population than congressional districts, meaning they're often more geographically compact. As Democratic voters have crowded into cities and commuter suburbs, and voters in rural and exurban areas have grown increasingly Republican, GOP mapmakers say that they risk running afoul of other redistricting criteria if they split up those densely populated Democratic areas across multiple state legislative districts. What you see is reflective of the more even distribution of Republican and right-leaning voters across wider geographic areas, said Adam Kincaid, director of the National Republican Redistricting Trust. Trying to draw more competitive legislative districts, he said, would result in just a lot of squiggly lines. Democrats note that Republicans are still cracking apart liberal communities, especially in suburbs near Akron and Cleveland in Ohio, and in predominantly black counties in northern and central North Carolina, in a way that helps the GOP and cuts against a geographical argument. They are carving up Democratic voters where they can't pack them, said Garrett Arwa, director of campaigns at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Democrats have fewer opportunities to unilaterally draw state legislative maps, particularly in battleground states. Of the 14 states where the margin of the 2020 presidential race was fewer than 10 percentage points, Democrats are able to draw state legislative maps in just one, Nevada. Republicans control the redistricting process in six of those 14 states. The rest have divided governments, or their maps are drawn by commissions. But when Democrats have had an opening, they also have enacted significant gerrymanders at the state legislative level. In Nevada, Democrats are close to finalizing a map that would give them supermajorities in both chambers of the legislature, despite President Joe Biden winning just 51% of the state's vote last year. The same holds true in deeply blue states. In Illinois, newly drawn state Senate maps would give Republicans about 23% of the seats in the chamber, even though former President Donald Trump won more than 40% of voters in the state in 2020. Republicans have taken two approaches to ensure durable majorities in state legislatures. The tactics in Texas and Georgia are more subtle, while Republicans in Ohio and North Carolina have taken more brazen steps. In Texas and Georgia, the party has largely eliminated competitive districts and made Republican and Democratic seats safer. In Ohio and North Carolina, however, Republicans are taking a forceful tack. By keeping some districts moderately competitive, they are taking more risks to create significant majorities or supermajorities, and in doing so, they are often flouting laws or court decisions. Immigration. Some states dropping contentious Alien Term by Acacia Coronado. The Associated Press, Byline, Austin, Texas. Luz Rivas remembers seeing the word on her mother's residency card as a child, alien. In the stark terms of the government, it signaled her mother was not yet a citizen of the U.S. But to her young daughter, the word had a more personal meaning. Even though they were going through the naturalization process, it meant the family did not belong. I want other children of immigrants, like me, to not feel the way I did, that my family did, when we saw the word alien, said Rivas, now an assemblywoman in the California legislature. The Democratic lawmakers sought to retire the term, and this year wrote a bill, since signed into law, that replaces the use of alien in state statutes with other terms such as non-citizen or immigrant. Her effort was inspired by a similar shift this year by the Biden administration. Immigrants and immigrant rights groups say the term, especially when combined with illegal, is dehumanizing and can have a harmful effect on immigration policy. The word became a focal point of debate in several states this year, as the number of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border swelled and led to fierce backlash against Biden administration policies by Republican governors and lawmakers. Lawmakers in at least seven states considered eliminating the use of alien and illegal in state statutes this year and replacing them with descriptors such as undocumented and non-citizen, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Only two states, California and Colorado, actually made the change. I want all Californians that are contributing to our society, that are small business owners, that work hard to feel that they are part of California communities, Rivas said of the reason behind her legislation. State Senator Julie Gonzalez, who co-sponsored the new Colorado law, said during a legislative committee hearing that words such as illegal were dehumanizing and derogatory when applied to immigrants. Gonzalez said the legislation aimed to remove the only place in Colorado statute where illegal alien was used to describe people living in the U.S. illegally. That language has been offensive for many people, she said. And some of the rationale behind that is really rooted in this idea that a person can certainly commit an illegal act, but no human being themselves is illegal. Using alien to describe those who are not U.S. citizens has a long history, dating to the nation's first naturalization law, passed while George Washington was president. Fearing a war with France, Congress also passed the Aliens and Sedition Acts in 1798, which sought to suppress political subversion. Changing the long-standing government terminology around immigration is not universally accepted as necessary or desirable. Sage Nauman, spokesperson for the Colorado Senate Republicans, said the Democratic-controlled legislature should be spending its time on matters of deeper importance to residents, such as taking steps to fight inflation, tackle crime, and improve education. Nauman said he doubted that the average Coloradan or American cares about what semi-controversial words are buried in their state statutes. An analysis by the Associated Press, which doesn't refer to people as aliens except in direct quotes, found that more than a dozen states still use the terms alien or illegal in statutes referring to immigrants. Among them is Texas, where a legislative attempt to transition to different terminology advanced out of committee with bipartisan backing this year, but failed to get a hearing before the full House. Our history is so much more than a blurb in the back of the textbook. Adding Voices, a new group of young Black historians plan to preserve and tell Colorado's story in a more diverse and inclusive way, by Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. Dexter Nelson II remembers being one of two Black kids in his classroom in Oklahoma when a teacher started talking about slavery. "All eyes are on you," he said, "but you're like, I'm not a slave." Now, as an historian with a master's degree in museum studies from the University of Central Oklahoma, Nelson knows Black history is so much deeper and richer than what's been taught in schools. Back in the classroom, it's slavery, MLK, and Rosa Parks, That's it, Nelson said. Our history is so much more than the blurb in the back of the textbook. Nelson is among a new cohort of young black historians who arrived this fall in Colorado amid a national reckoning over race relations and disputes over how to accurately frame America's racist past in classrooms. They're here to preserve history and tell the state's stories without whitewashing the past. They also want to celebrate black lives in Colorado by telling stories that don't just revolve around trauma. History Colorado hired Nelson, 30, 5 months ago as its associate curator of black history and cultural heritage. Madeline Alexander, 29, started working November 1st as History Colorado's engagement coordinator for black communities, and Jordan Lewis, 22, joined the staff in June as a new digital communications specialist. Meanwhile, Ashley Lawrence Sanders, 38, became the only black person teaching in the University of Colorado's history department when she started in August in Boulder. They joined Jamika Lewis, a 39-year-old senior librarian at Denver's Blair Caldwell African American Research Library, who is making a mark in the community after working at the library for almost 5 years. For me, it's a heavy responsibility and burden because most of the time in historical circles and in the museum field specifically, I'm the only one that looks like me in these rooms, Nelson said. It's important to acknowledge that and know we are the change we want to see, and we are doing that. The five say they want to help Colorado tell its story in a more diverse and inclusive way. Lawrence Sanders came to Colorado from the University of Dayton in Ohio, where most of her students were white, and she often was their first black female professor. So far, it's been the same in Boulder. At this time, when there's so much confusion on black history and what's taught, I think it's important that black history professors are here, she said. Lawrence Sanders said she was trained by black historians to research and teach African American history. It's not the same as studying white history because the sources for the work are different. She frequently hears students tell her that they had never heard about the characters and events covered in her classroom. I'm never adding black people into the story, she said. I start with black people. At History Colorado, Alexander's job is to reach black communities and encourage them to share their stories. She especially wants to collect stories from Colorado's African immigrant community. And she believes in finding positive stories, not just those surrounding traumatic events. I want to focus on black joy, Alexander said. There's so much triggering content, and then we get caught in this trauma loop. But we have to find spaces of joy, and black joy is a form of resistance. We have to make sure we are celebrating ourselves in the face of oppression. History Colorado, then, is a space for me to do that, to go into communities and say, what do you love about yourself? Let's share it with everyone else. An historian's job is not to pacify people because the past is unpleasant, Lewis said. Sometimes those truths and facts are ugly, Lewis said. She hopes her job as a digital communications specialist helps other people find their voices. If you have it, use it, she said. At the Blair Caldwell Library, Lewis's primary job is supervising the first floor stacks where people come to read, study, and check out books. But she wanders up to the second and third floors as often as possible to research Denver's black history. One of her favorite artifacts is the 1834 manumission document carried by Robert Smith, a freed slave, as he traveled to Denver from Forsyth, Virginia. Smith would have been required to show the papers to any white person who asked to prove that he was free. It puts everything in a different perspective, she said. Being black and knowing what our ancestors endured and knowing that what we know is not even a fraction of what actually happened, I mean, it's controversial to say, but I think black professionals should be in charge of black history. We have different lived experiences. We have different ways of appreciating that history. Terry Nelson, a veteran research librarian at Blair Caldwell, said she welcomes the new generation to Denver's community of historians. It's like the skeleton of the body. If it's not well put together, it doesn't stand. It's like a knob on the axle on a wagon. If the axle isn't strong, the pieces feeding into the axle won't be able to take the pressure, Nelson said, of developing the next generation to tell diverse stories. That's the history of our lives. It's usually the elders who have lived the life, and we're trying to pass the challenges they had and how to handle them to the modern world, and to learn to appreciate them and not to let them feel defeat, but to let them look forward and think about the future and what they can do better to not repeat it. Plundered pieces, debate over Benin bronze. Denver Art Museum has owned its piece since 1955. Other nations are returning relics taken from Africa, by Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. British troops in 1897 mounted a violent, retaliatory raid on the Kingdom of Benin in what's now northern Nigeria, looting and burning the royal palace and sending the Oba, or king, into exile. The British confiscated all the royal treasures from their colonial subjects, giving some to officers, but taking most to a London auction to help pay for the expedition. Those rare Benin bronzes over the past century were dispersed to hundreds of institutions around the world, including the Denver Art Museum, where a 16th or 17th century bronze plaque is one of 11 items in the museum's collection originating from the former Kingdom of Benin. Now, amid a worldwide reckoning over colonial history and a racial justice movement, pressure is mounting for art collections such as Denver's to give the relics back to their rightful owners. European institutions have led the charge, pledging to return Benin bronzes to help Africa rebuild lost art collections after centuries of plunder. But American collections have been slower to get on board. It's not just taking the artwork. That was an act of war, said Dan Hicks, a British curator and professor whose book, The Brutish Museums, The Benin Bronzes, Colonial Violence, and Cultural Restitution, makes the case for repatriating the artifacts to Nigeria. The continued display of these items in these museums represents for many an enduring act of violence. The Denver Art Museum has not displayed any of its Benin pieces for years, museum officials said in a statement, and last year began working with experts so we could better understand their complete provenance. At this time, none of these objects are on view, and the museum has not been contacted by Nigeria with queries for information or with requests for the objects' return, according to the statement. The debate over the Benin bronzes comes as the Denver Art Museum grapples with the history of its own collection. This month, the museum voluntarily gave up four Cambodian antiquities after federal authorities moved to seize the items. The U.S. Department of Justice alleged that the relics sold to the museum by Douglas Latchford, who was indicted in 2019 for trafficking looted antiquities, were plundered from the Southeast Asian nation. How Denver got its Benin bronze. Benin bronzes are a bit of a misnomer. They're neither uniformly bronze nor from the country of Benin. The former Kingdom of Benin sits in southern Nigeria. The artifacts include works from carved elephant tusks to ivory statues and wooden heads, in addition to the iconic bronze plaques such as the one in the Denver Art Museum. The royal palace of the Oba, or King of Benin, was adorned with hundreds of elaborately ornamented plaques, such as this one, telling the story of court life, reads the plaque's description on the Denver Art Museum's website. Cast in the lost wax technique by a highly skilled artisan, this plaque has the figure of a court nobleman or possibly a chief, showing details of his regalia, including his helmet, an elaborate coral necklace, embroidered skirt, belt, and anklets. The museum acquired the plaque in 1955 from the Carlsbad Gallery in New York City. The piece was taken in 1897 by Sir Ralph Moore, who led the African region's British protectorate and the Benin City Raid from the Kingdom of Benin and sent to the British Foreign Service Office collection, according to the known provenance section of the item's webpage, which traces its history and acquisition. The plaque is number 60 of the 300 taken by Moore and displayed initially in the British Museum, according to Hicks, the British curator. About 100 of those were variously sold or given away. The bronze plaque is the only object of the 11 in the Denver Art Museum that we can confirm was removed from the kingdom by the British Foreign Service in 1897, museum officials said. In addition to taking a closer look at its Benin collection last year, the museum staff is participating in a project called Digital Benin, a German-led initiative that will bring together photographs, oral histories, and rich documentation material from collections worldwide to provide a long-requested overview of the royal artworks looted in the 19th century. The project's website states, it plans to launch in 2022. Benin bronzes can be found in collections in England and Germany, New York and California, and they can fetch significant prices. One Benin bronze, a head of an Oba, sold in 2007 for $4.74 million. The Tsar Savoy Report. The discussion surrounding plundered art during colonial times received a jolt in 2017 when Emmanuel Macron, the French president, told a group of students in Burkina Faso that returning African artifacts housed in his home country would become a top priority. I cannot accept that a large part of cultural heritage from several African countries is in France, Macron said. African heritage just can't be in European private collections and museums. Macron commissioned a report, and the authors recommended in 2018 that objects removed and sent to mainland France without the consent of their countries of origin be permanently returned if the country of origin asks for them. The numbers behind colonial art plundering are startling. Some 90% to 95% of Africa's cultural heritage is held outside the continent by major museums, experts estimated in the French report. Known as the Tsar Savoy Report, it set off a domino effect across Europe and eventually the United States. Germany announced in April that it will begin returning about 1,100 Benin bronzes from its museums to Nigeria. A Dutch committee last year recommended the unconditional return of objects to former colonies of the Netherlands. Last month, the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art in Washington, D.C., removed 10 Benin bronze pieces from display and committed to repatriating them to Nigeria. We recognize the trauma, violence, and loss such displays of stolen artistic and cultural heritage can inflict on the victims of those crimes, their descendants, and broader communities, the museum said on its website. Repatriating items should be taken on a case-by-case approach, Hicks said. We're not talking about emptying museums and sending everything back. It's about being open to giving back when asked. But artwork, such as the Benin bronze housed in Denver, is the anthropology of that time, he said. They're being used to tell a story of cultural supremacy, which has no place in what we think of art museums today. In an essay titled, Give Us Back What Our Ancestors Made, Nigerian artist Victor Ekemener writes of the dejection he felt seeing these masterful works, iconic displays of his culture, hanging in staid British museums. Generations of Africans have already lost incalculable history and cultural reference points because of the absence of some of the best artworks created on the continent, Ekemener wrote. We shouldn't have to ask over and over to get back what is ours. Nigeria plans to open a museum in Benin City in 2023 with at least 300 Benin bronzes, populated mainly with pieces returning from major European collections. I want people to be able to understand their past and see who we were. Godwin Obaseki, governor of Edo State, home to Benin City, told the New York Times. America taking its time. While European institutions have taken the lead on repatriating artifacts, American collections have been quite slow to respond to this, said Rashida Bumbray, Director of Culture and Art for the Open Society Foundations, a global grant-making network that last year pledged $15 million toward bringing cultural objects back to Africa. "The Smithsonian's announcement changes the game," Bumbray said. "But the U.S. is falling behind. Many museums have been slow to respond to demands for greater transparency in their acquisition practices and for stricter ethical practices," said Elizabeth Campbell, a University of Denver professor who runs the school's Center for Art Collection Ethics. "Provenance research is very expensive, laborious, time-consuming, and it has not been prioritized," Campbell said. "Many museums are investing in acquisition and not research. We hope that's changing as they face better scrutiny. The challenge with provenance research, according to a Denver Art Museum list of frequently asked questions, is capacity and time, as we have more than 70,000 works in our collection. A multi-departmental provenance committee meets biweekly to discuss provenance projects," the museum stated. The Denver Art Museum has faced other repatriation efforts for pieces in its collection. The museum gave up the four Cambodian antiquities connected to Latchford and is examining two more pieces from Thailand connected with the now-deceased art dealer. The museum in September also repatriated a Nepalese statue and in 2016 returned a statue to Cambodia that had been looted during its tumultuous civil war in the 1970s. "There's precedent now for institutions to give back Benin bronzes," Hicks said, pointing to Germany as a global leader. "The question now is," he said, "will this be led from Denver as well?" COVID-19 in Colorado. Neither school districts nor state likely to embrace mandates soon. Students have been required to get certain shots for decades, but some parents hesitating with new vaccine. By Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Coloradans ages 5 to 11 are eligible to get vaccinated against the coronavirus, but the state health department and school districts aren't rushing to require the shots to attend school. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is unlikely to require COVID-19 vaccines for K-12 students before the U.S. Food and Drug Administration fully approves Pfizer shot for children, said an agency spokesperson in an email. Schools have required certain vaccines for students for decades, and public health experts said a mandate could help increase uptake among families hesitant about the shots. The debate over whether to mandate COVID-19 vaccines for school children is still in its infancy. California is the first state to require the shots for schools, although Colorado does have a patchwork of requirements for adults in certain professions. For example, healthcare workers are required to get the shots. And people attending large indoor events, such as concerts and bars, in six metro Denver counties also have to show proof of immunization. School districts, including Jeffco Public Schools and Cherry Creek School District, said they are reluctant to require the vaccines without a directive from state or local public health departments. "We take our direction from our state and county health departments, and we would not require vaccines unless the state or tri-county health department mandated that students get the vaccine," said Abby Smith, spokeswoman for Cherry Creek School District, in a statement. A spokesman for Denver Public Schools did not directly answer whether it would consider requiring the shots. Instead, spokesman Will Jones said the district is working with Denver Health to offer the vaccines to students and families. "At this point, we are focused on helping to get as many students vaccinated as quickly as possible," he said in an email. Children and teens are experiencing higher rates of coronavirus infections than they did previously in the pandemic, as Colorado is experiencing a surge in cases that is on the verge of overrunning the state's hospital system. Colorado public health officials have a goal of immunizing at least half of the state's 479,895 children ages 5 to 11 by the end of January. So far, just under 82,000 Coloradans in the age group have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, according to the health department. Children are less likely to experience severe illness, but it's still possible for them to become hospitalized. They are also at risk of developing a rare condition called multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or MIS-C, that can damage the heart and other organs after an infection. They can also develop persisting symptoms in what is known as long COVID. School vaccine mandates have existed in the United States since at least 1855, when the state of Massachusetts required students to get inoculated against smallpox. Colorado requires students to get shots that protect against diseases such as chickenpox, measles, and hepatitis B, unless they have an exemption. School mandates mostly occur on the state level, and public health experts said they expect to see a patchwork of COVID-19 vaccine policies across the nation. It's not a new concept, so Dr. William Moss, executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. But, he said, he expects pushback from parents on school requirements for COVID-19 vaccines, especially given they are still under emergency use authorization from the FDA. By waiting until the agency fully approves the shots, state officials will provide more time for people to observe how the vaccine does in children and give public health officials time to build trust with families, Moss said. School vaccine mandates have kind of gone under the radar for a long time, and they have been in place for 100 years or so. But this is a very politicized vaccine, he said. In most states, including Colorado, boards of health are able to add more vaccines to their lists of school immunization requirements. So there is a solid legal ground for state officials to require COVID-19 vaccines for school children, said Daniel Goldberg, a public health law expert at the CU Center for Bioethics and Humanities. Can they do it? Absolutely, he said. Will they do it? He shrugged. Right now, the demand for COVID-19 vaccines is driven by parents who really want to get their children immunized. This has created a situation where demand for the shot exceeds supply. Musk doesn't think that there should be school vaccine mandates while there is a shortage in doses. My own view is that it's premature to have vaccine mandates for the 5 to 11-year-old group, he said. However, he expects the United States will quickly hit a wall, as it did with teenagers, where supply exceeds the people getting the shots. A school vaccine mandate would be one way the state could increase immunizations once demand begins to slow, Goldberg said. A recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 1/3 of American parents plan to wait and see how well the COVID-19 vaccine works before immunizing their young child. These parents aren't completely opposed to the shot for their children, but they have concerns about potential long-term side effects and want to wait to see how vaccinations of the age group play out. A mandate most likely would influence this group of parents to vaccinate their child, Goldberg said. That's huge in terms of its impact on community spread, he said. Men's World Cup races will return to Birds of Prey on December 3rd through the 5th, by John LeConte, Vail Daily. The Xfinity Birds of Prey World Cup speed races in Beaver Creek have been confirmed following the International Ski Federation's official snow control on November 21st. The races will take place December 3rd through 5th, with two Super G races and a downhill scheduled. We look forward to hosting the world's best men's alpine ski racers as they make their journey toward the 2022 Olympic Winter Games, said Mike Imhoff, president of the Vail Valley Foundation, which has been the local organizing committee for the Birds of Prey races in Beaver Creek since 1997. Thanks to hard work, an amazing team, and a phenomenal man-made snowmaking system, plus a little cooperation from Mother Nature, we expect a sensational return to racing on this iconic course. We are grateful for the support of our partners at the FIS, U.S. Ski and Snowboard, Vail Resorts, U.S. Forest Service, the Beaver Creek Resort Company, Beaver Creek Resort Ski and Snowboard Club Vail, and everyone on the snowmaking and course building teams, including our amazing volunteers, to help get this course ready for training November 30th and racing December 3rd through the 5th. Well, Beaver Creek often hosts the men's tech skiers as well for a giant slalom race. This year, the tech and speed events are being kept separate to reduce the chance of COVID-19 spreading among the different groups of alpine ski racing. In news briefs, Beaver Creek Resort eyes Monday for opening day. With the assistance of Mother Nature and its mountain operations team, Beaver Creek Resort is targeting to kick off its season Monday. The mountain initially was scheduled to open Wednesday. However, citing unseasonably warm weather and a lack of snowfall, the resort pushed back its opening day. But with recent weather patterns, including a dusting of snow and low temperatures, Beaver Creek snowmakers and mountain operations teams have been able to better prepare the mountain for opening, according to an email from Rachel Levitsky, the Beaver Creek communications manager. Aurora police believe alcohol a factor in fatal two-vehicle crash. A woman was killed when the car she was riding in collided with another late Friday at a busy Aurora intersection. The Aurora Police Department says that at about midnight Friday, a Nissan sedan collided with a Ford SUV at North Airport Boulevard and East 6th Avenue. Officials say the Nissan was going north on Airport Boulevard when it ran a red light, striking the Ford traveling east on 6th Avenue. Police believe the man driving the Nissan was under the influence of alcohol. He remains in the hospital with a broken leg. The woman riding in the front seat of the Nissan was killed. The person driving the Ford was not injured. The Arapahoe County Coroner's Office has not released the woman's identity. The woman's death marks the 38th traffic fatality in Aurora this year. One dead, two shot, one stabbed in post-Thanksgiving incidents in Denver. Black Friday was a violent day in Denver, as a man was killed and several people were wounded in incidents police are investigating. Denver police say a man was killed in the 4500 block of West 2nd Street before 2:30 p.m. Friday. Officials are investigating the cause of death and ask for those with information to call 720-913-STOP. Police tweeted early Friday that they were investigating a stabbing in the 300 block of South Raleigh Street. One man was taken to a hospital with serious wounds, police said. Officials say a shooting in the 7600 block of East 28th Avenue sent one man to a hospital. Police reported the shooting after 1:30 a.m. Saturday. There was another shooting early Saturday, according to police. One man was shot in the 3600 block of West Linvale Place. These briefs were from staff and wire reports. Medicine. A cure for type 1 diabetes? For one man, it seems to have worked. By Gina Collada, The New York Times Company. Brian Shelton's life was ruled by type 1 diabetes. When his blood sugar plummeted, he would lose consciousness without warning. He crashed his motorcycle into a wall. He passed out in a customer's yard while delivering mail. Following that episode, his supervisors told him to retire. After a quarter century with the Postal Service, he was 57. His ex-wife, Cindy Shelton, took him into her home in Elyria, Ohio. "I was afraid to leave him alone all day," she said. Early this year, she spotted a call for people with type 1 diabetes to participate in a clinical trial by Vertex Pharmaceuticals. The company was testing a treatment developed over decades by a scientist who vowed to find a cure after his baby son and then his teenage daughter got the devastating disease. Brian Shelton was the first patient. On June 29th, he got an infusion of cells grown from stem cells, but just like the insulin-producing pancreas cells his body lacked. Now, his body automatically controls its insulin and blood sugar levels. Shelton, now 64, may be the first person cured of the disease with a new treatment that has experts daring to hope that help may be coming for many of the 1.5 million Americans suffering from type 1 diabetes. It's a whole new life, Shelton said. It's like a miracle. Diabetes experts were astonished, but urged caution. The study is continuing and will take 5 years, involving 17 people with severe cases of type 1 diabetes. It is not intended as a treatment for the more common type 2 diabetes. We've been looking for something like this to happen literally for decades, said Dr. Earl Hirsch, a diabetes expert at the University of Washington who was not involved in the research. He wants to see the result, not yet published in a peer-reviewed journal, replicated in many more people. He also wants to know if there will be unanticipated adverse effects and if the cells will last for a lifetime or if the treatment would have to be repeated. But he said, bottom line, it is an amazing result. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
According to an ancient Turkish myth, the moon is the wife of the sun, and the spots on the moon's face come from when the sun threw mud at it. Astronomers still appreciate the magic and the mystery of the moon as much as any of us, but they see the moon's face as a record of its history. I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet.
The dark areas are circular. They are impact basins that were created by objects hundreds of kilometers across, crashing into the moon after it had separated from the Earth and become a homogeneous body on its own.
Jeff Chester is an astronomer and public affairs officer with the U.S. Naval Observatory.
Now, the highland areas are kind of like the original surface of the moon, but if you look at them through a telescope, they have just been battered by hundreds of thousands of smaller objects. It is a very impressive record of the early history of the formation of our solar system.
Scientists have been able to geologically date much of the moon's surface, and they say that the last of its large craters was probably carved out about 100 million years ago. But there's tantalizing evidence that one of the moon's craters is much younger. People living in England in the 12th century may have actually witnessed its formation.
There's an account by some monks in Canterbury around the year 1138, which record a very unusual appearance of the moon, black smoke and flames. And the description of the location of this particular event happens to coincide with an area where there happens to be a very fresh-looking 25-kilometer diameter impact crater. they may have seen the creation of that. But until we actually go there and sample the material in that crater, we cannot tell for sure how old it is.
To hear about our new CD, please visit pulseplanet.com. Pulse of the Planet is made possible by the National Science Foundation.
Income-qualifying Commerce City residents can apply for the weatherization service. This service performs energy audits, seals air leaks, installs insulation, furnace, and water heater repairs and replacements for low to moderate income households. For more information or to apply, contact the Arapahoe County Weatherization at 303-636-1982 or visit their website at arapahogov.com.